Robotaxi has to get to a point where you can go from Georgetown to downtown Austin, or you can go from Bertram or Bastrop to downtown Austin. And all of a sudden you're like, holy shit, the entire jurisdiction of Austin city proper is now covered.
My prediction is that Apple is going to get Twittered sometime in the next 10 years.
Do I enjoy watching Apple completely and utterly fall flat on its face on artificial intelligence? The opposite. Because I can't tell you how many times I've been on my computer and I'm like, I wish I could just prompt my computer to do the thing I'm going to do for the next 2 hours.
And no one is in a better position to build OS native AI than Apple. But they're just pissing into the wind.
So today I did another ride. I rode the Shillong 6 times. I think something like that. Six times. No, can't get enough. Today I got charged a higher price. So yesterday was $420. Today was $690. So they raised the fare, like they said. I mean, it's getting to the point now, like it's not just like a hobby thing now for me, like, or like a content thing for the channel. It's legitimately useful now. It added about 5 minutes, but now my cost is, for the Robotaxi, I'm paying $14 all in. And the ride to Capital Factory and the Robotaxi, I have to pay zero attention. Whereas with the Robotaxi, with the Cybertruck, I would have it on FSD, but it's supervised. I still have to pay attention. So I could listen to a podcast, et cetera. But when I'm in the Robotaxi, I don't have to pay any attention whatsoever. And so, for example, today I recorded a video, which I could have done in my Cybertruck as well, but it was in the Robotaxi. So that was the part of the content. But I could have also been on Grok doing research. I could have been, you know, on X doing research, you know, reading through articles, being on YouTube, flipping through my phone, whatever I needed to do. So now it's opened up this time for me to be a little bit more productive, and it's lowered my cost to come down to the city as well. Now this is at the $6.90 price, and
how much are you paying for parking up there where you're at, where you parked today?
Zero. Yeah, because I just parked at a big parking lot with like a bunch of stores or whatever. So it's like, yep. I just park, like, I'm not going to get towed or nothing. It's like that parking lot's probably 80% empty 99% of the time. So I'm able to just park there and have the Robotaxi come. So now the expansion all of a sudden has created this environment for me where I'm going to use it, not because it's cool, but because it makes sense. And this is where this technology is going to start being super impactful for people. But it's highly dependent on Tesla being able to get to a point where they can have a geofence that's usable, right? So this can't be like Waymo is very useful for people that live in Austin, that want to be in Austin, that travel within Austin. And Uber is useful within those confines, but then Uber can also take you technically anywhere, right? Within like a reasonable radius that people would drive. That's where Robotaxi has to get. Robotaxi has to get to a point where you can go from Georgetown to downtown Austin, or you can go from Bertram or Bastrop to downtown Austin, or, you know, San Marcos or Waco, or even Dallas and San Antonio to Austin. That's when this thing really starts kicking off and becoming super useful. And then
Which
what's going to be interesting,
yeah. Kind of the direction that it seems like they're going, if, you know, they're running the validation testing right now down in Kyle, which is like the same distance south of the original geofence as the current expansion is to the north. That's like, you know, a long ways away from where the core traffic of the riders who want to use Tesla Robotaxi are going to be. So the fact that they're already doing that, and, you know, it's like we saw it was about a 2-week lag time from when they were running those validation cars in downtown Austin to when they opened up the service in downtown Austin. So like in 2 to 3 weeks from now, we could have that service area that's significantly larger. And, you know, my guess is, you know, based on them wanting to do the specific shape of the expansion, that they actually could have done a much larger expansion area to the north.
Yes.
And they trimmed it back, not expanded it.
And I saw James Dalma posted about this yesterday or 2 days ago. And I was talking about this.
Him and CERN both, yeah.
Yeah, and this is something that when I was taking my Robotaxi rides, when I hailed my first one in the expanded region, it's sort of like, this was before I read their messages. And I recorded on video, I was like, man, this shape, like if you think about the logistics that go into making that shape, the upside down T, let's say, right? The shape of the geofence. By default, if you're somebody that has to map and has to use, like you have to draw it with purpose, all of a sudden you're asking yourself, why am I doing this? Right? Why am I trying to fit the shape that's not going to maximize my density? It's not going to maximize my my optimal routes. It's not maximizing for the spots that I geofenced. It's like an arbitrary shape. But the arbitrary
shape,
just for the memes. But that speaks volumes, because that speaks to Tesla's ability to have a lot of flexibility. And so by default, like let's say your point, which is like they had a much bigger area, but they decided to go with a meme because, you know, the meme is funny and it's viral and it's going to get out there and it's going to raise awareness. And then in about a couple of weeks time, boom, the actual geofence that they wanted to use comes live. And all of a sudden you're like, holy shit, the entire jurisdiction of Austin city proper is now covered. And that includes places like the Domain, that includes places that are, you know, significantly farther away than where Waymo is today. And today Tesla's already has a bigger geofence than Waymo, but that shape points to the fact
in
that they're going to have
specifically
in Austin specifically. So, but that shape directly points to the fact that they're going to have an even bigger one. No pun intended. There's so many puns with this damn freaking geofence, man. But anyway, it's a big deal. So, what's your read? Not you know, you've experienced robotaxi quite a bit. You haven't experienced the new geofence, but you've gotten a good lay of the land. You've spoken to James Dalmo. You've spoken to Cern Bacher. You've talked to a bunch of people. You've thought about it deeply. So where are you landing, like, today on Tuesday, July 15th?
Well, I think the rate of expansion right now is, you know, quite the game changer. That, you know, we're just blowing things up right now. And one of the points that I made online was that, you know, two points make a line. That we doubled the expansion rate the geofence area in 3 weeks from launch. And that tells you that this general solution that they have created is much easier and faster to scale than what Waymo has. Now, you know, it's 2 points. So like I said, we only have a line. You don't know, is it an actual line or is this a curve? Like, are they going to double the geofence every 3 weeks? Or are they just going to add, you know, the same area roughly every 3 weeks? Or, you know, is it going to change? What's that going to look like? I think we're going to get a lot more information about that over the next month. Like, I would be shocked at this point in time if we don't see Kyle, Texas included in the service coverage area. And then if we have Kyle, like, where else the heck do we have? My guess is that we do go out and include the Gigafactory. Although, you know, obviously, you would think that they would want to be able to offer this service to all of their employees who work at the Tesla Gigafactory. I know that they already offer it to some of their employees. So the question is, you know, where do all of the employees live, and what's the difficulty in being able to include, you know, 80 or 90% of the Gigafactory employees in the coverage area? You know, because that's a huge deal. It's not exactly cheap, you know, to live near where the factory is. And while, you know, Tesla is pretty generous on its stock option program and people can end up being compensated extremely well who are just normal everyday factory employees, that compensation isn't really, you know, just in the form of their take-home salary, which makes it then hard to cover expenses. And so anyways, all that to say that if they can offer free or even cheap robo-taxi transportation to and from work for these people that are having to travel back and forth 30, 45, an hour and a half into the factory, and they can get that time where they don't have to pay attention, they don't have to drive, they don't have to deal with the traffic, all of those things, and they're, you know, running. Like, I think, you know, this is one of the reasons why the RoboVan is something that they will want to get running sooner rather than later, just because it makes so much sense for this type of application. But yeah, like, that's a huge perk for people that are having to do that. And, you know, the Gigafactory is just one place where people work in Austin who are all having to deal with that exact dynamic. Like, if you could sign up for a membership to the Tesla Robotaxi platform that got you to and from work every day for $20, and you know, you have long commutes or whatever, and you get all that time back, like, that is so worth it. And yeah, like, Tesla can offer that service to its employees potentially for free as a perk. But for anyone who lives in the Austin area who's got to deal with that, like, that's a huge deal and a huge economic, it's a win for, you know, pretty much everyone involved all the way around. So, like, I think we're pretty much there. We're ready for, like, the technology, the foundation of what they have built is built for that. It's very, very near. The question is just how long do they want to continue to play it safe? And I think it's going to be a difficult situation for, you know, Tesla to navigate philosophically, because if you really want to maximize the good that you do for humans, it does require, like, tens of thousands of road deaths every year, right? Under the current regime. And obviously Tesla's going to get a ton of criticism and hate that first time that there's a fatality with a Tesla Robotaxi that's involved, regardless of whether that car is at fault or not. It could be, you know, someone else. But it's going, like, the headlines are going to go out as soon as it happens that it was Tesla's fault, even if it wasn't. And then, you know, we'll get the investigation and everything will come out over time, but everyone will have moved on and it'll, you know, be stuck in a lot of people's minds that it was the car's fault. But that said, you know, that thing is going to happen at some point. And if we try and delay it too much, there's a lot of people that actually end up dying because they were riding around in human-driven vehicles for longer. And, you know, we have the opportunity to reduce this death toll. And it just is a matter of having the organizational courage to weather that storm. So trying to figure out what the timing is on all of that is a challenge that, you know, I think Tesla, the executive team, I'm sure they've talked about this at length and extensively. Like, when do we make the decision to go ahead and expand, knowing that, you know, if you're driving millions of miles every week or every month or, you know, whatever it is, at that point in time, that there's basically an unavoidable accident rate at that level of scale. And Waymo already, you know, they have hundreds of accidents every year. I don't know that there's been any fatalities, and most of them are not Waymo's fault, and no one knows, no one cares. They just think, you know, hey, it's working, it's fine. But that's just not going to be the case for Tesla. So yeah, that's the, you know, those are the things that I'm thinking about. Because, you know, after experiencing the car, I'm like, this is ready as far as I can tell. The way that it feels, the smoothness that it drives with, the planning horizon is excellent. Everything is dialed in. You know, there's some more work to be done around pickup and drop offs, but, you know, that's not a huge surprise. It's already good. It can be a little bit better. It obviously will get better, and it will get better rapidly. You know, they've already fixed a number of the things that people complained about with the app, and it's just gonna, you know, it's going to expand rapidly. So really, you know, like the core thing that if we had the ability to see it that I would want to see is just what's the number of paid miles, like cumulative paid miles. And I would like to see that chart, and I want to see it, you know, it's going to start out here and then it's going to tick up and it's going to tick up and it's going to tick up. But I don't think they're going to give us that. So we just basically have to go off of secondary data points. And the best one that we have, obviously, is the coverage area. Beyond that, if we can get some sort of a sense of how many cars there are, like cars and square miles covered are good proxies for how many miles they're going to be adding to the system. And then, you know, I think it'll be interesting to see what they do with their safety monitors. Do they, you know, roll out safety monitors in each location that they're expanding to? Or do they just keep them until they've got like 1,000,000 miles under their belt? And then as soon as they, you know, pass the 1,000,000 mile belt, then just all safety monitors everywhere pretty much go away. That'll be the other data point. But yeah, like as far as we can see, they're rapidly expanding the service area. We assume they have to be expanding the fleet. I know we haven't gotten confirmation of that.
Hasn't happened yet.
But yeah, that's it's all pointing in the right direction at this point.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with basically everything you said. I think the ecosystem piece is an interesting one, you know, with the bus or whatever the hell you want to call the toaster. I call it the toaster. The avant-garde toaster or whatever.
The robo toaster.
Yeah, the robo toaster or Roboven. So that's very interesting. So if you start, you know, like if I was thinking about this with like the conversation around AI too, like Grok, implementing Grok into the vehicles, it just opens up, it like makes the future a lot more clear if you really think through it. Before I mention that, I want to sort of talk through the Kyle piece a little bit and the factory one, because if they expand to Kyle, by default, that means they're going to do highway, because there's no way in hell you're going to get down to Kyle without taking 35. It's going to take you forever, right? So because the suburban roads are going to take forever. You're going to go through a lot of like slow roads. 35 will get you there in like 30 minutes. If you don't take 35, even with traffic, it'll get you down there 45, 50 on a regular traffic-y day. If you don't take 35, it'll take you an hour plus at least to get down to Kyle. So I think the Kyle expansion goes hand in hand with the highway, opening up highways. And if they do expand to Kyle in the next 3 weeks to say couple months or whatever, end of the year, then by default, they're going to open up the highways. And with the highways opening up, you're all of a sudden also opening up access to the factory. Because the factory, access to in and out of the factory, if you look at the map on Google, there are pathways to connect Austin and the factory without taking the highway. But it's, again, a Kyle situation. It's not that far away from the city, but it's far enough where taking a highway makes too, like you have to take the highway to get there.
And if you do highways, then you're already doing things that Waymo doesn't do.
Thank you to the sponsor of this podcast, Rebellion Air. Now, we know a lot of you are Tesla fans, and especially Tesla investors. And if you have more than $1 million of Tesla stock, Rebellion Air could be the perfect fit for you. Rebellion Air is an investment firm that helps Tesla investors reach their financial goals. They do this by helping you plan for your future, and they also institute strategies like trimming and adding, covered calls, etc. So if you're somebody who believes that Tesla has long-term potential, these kinds of strategies could maximize the number of shares you have by the time Tesla reaches those goals. And the guys at Rebellion Air do this by doing so much research on the Tesla story, and they do a lot of novel research as well. Things like doing cross-country full self-driving trips to really gauge and truly understand the capability of that specific software. They've done really novel research around the energy side of the business and other parts of the business as well. And so instead of dealing with a typical investment firm that may give you the cold shoulder by viewing your investment as too risky, the guys at Rebellion Air will help you reach your goals while fully understanding the Tesla story. And so if you're a Tesla investor and you have more than $1 million of shares, and you're interested in finding out more about Rebellion Air, I have a link for you in the description in the comment section below. You can go to rebellionair.com/Farzad, and that's how they'll know that we sent you. And now back to the podcast.
In Austin. I believe they take highways in LA, if I'm not mistaken. But exactly. So the highway piece is what connects your suburban rural areas to your urban centers. And that's when you start going to your San Marcos and your Waco and your Bertrams and your Bastrops, right? And then all the way up to Dallas and San Antonio. And maybe you could link it all the way down to Houston, right? And you kind of go that route. So those two go hand in hand. The ecosystem piece with the toaster, the Robovan, and sort of like talking about the Tesla membership for transportation. You know, I think the pathway for a company like Tesla to get to a point where transportation, it's like transportation as a service kind of thing, is becoming very clear and obvious. So it's like this, it's going to become this app model where it doesn't matter where you are, you're going to have access to a robo taxi in the United States in the next 5 years' time. it doesn't matter where you are, you're going to have access to the Robotaxi app, and you might have a membership that say, pay $50 a month, you get to ride a Robotaxi for free, whatever, like whatever the number is, right? $100 a month. And it doesn't matter where you are, you hail the Robotaxi, gets you from place to place. You can even take a cross-country trip if you really wanted to. And they're going to have an ecosystem that's going to be smart enough to know that, hey, okay, this person's trying to go from New York to LA. I should probably use the longest range vehicles I have in my fleet. I'm going to start allocating it to this trip. And then for each supercharger stop, right, I'm going to give the person maybe like a 30-minute layover time where I'm not going to charge them for idling fees. And during those 30 minutes, they can either choose to jump into another car. They can choose, right? Have a car ready for me so that I can lay over really fast. I can just grab my bag and throw it in the other one and keep going. Or, hey, I'm going to pause for 30 minutes. I'm going to take my allotted 30-minute time. Maybe you get a 10% discount for that leg or something. You can either use the bathroom, you can grab some food, and then the car just charges itself. And then you can use the same car to go down, right? And then, so there are ways to make the ecosystem work for Tesla to offer super long distances with Robotaxi. But then that is I don't know how big of a use case that's going to be. 90% plus of the miles are going to be, you know, intra-city, intra-metro area, right? So it's going to be like suburban to urban, or even rural to urban, and then back and forth in those areas. So, so with the integration of Grok in their vehicles, right, you can start to see that Tesla wants to create this ecosystem for a product that's deeply integrated with artificial intelligence. But what that's really made me think through is like, okay, so if you're going to have this ecosystem, and Grok is going to be integrated in that ecosystem, and Grok is going to remember memory in Grok on just the grok.com. So if you do a query, it just remembers what you've queried. So it's like, oh, I remember based on what you've said before, based on this, then it could, you know, it could be helpful to, you know, do this and blah, blah, blah. And you're going down the right path or whatever. It's going to be really annoying to have a car that remembers who you are, but then you go on your phone and then phone doesn't remember you from the car and vice versa, right? So if we're going to be people, if we're going to be a species that's going to use transportation to go from place to place, does this mean that Tesla then is just laying out the groundwork for this in-between device that's going to remember you in between you taking their cars, in between you taking the bus and the robo-van, in between you using the Musk universe of products? If you take a rocket to Mars, which is going to be integrated with Grok, you know, I'm kind of going off the rails a little bit, but it does open up this discussion around like the Musk ecosystem. Like, it's becoming obvious that Grok is going to be an integral part to the whole thing and how he's building Tesla and all the other companies.
Yeah, I think that context piece that you're talking about, that is a challenge, not just for Elon and XAI and Tesla, but really all of the model providers. Like, you do want to have memory. And I know all these ecosystems are going to want to offer you, you know, like vertically integrated memory that is within their own walled garden. But I think there's a huge opportunity for a player to come along and provide you with your personal context, your personal memory, that then you can set permissions for that so that it can be consumed by any different model that you're using. And so that it's persistent, that, you know, you can have a conversation with your Grok model, and the contents of the conversation are captured by your personal memory thing. And then you can have another conversation with a different model at a different point in time and ask it about that same memory. And it can provide it to you, which I think is a very interesting move that Perplexity just made, you know, going into having their own browser, because you can think of like that browser. If you use that browser and you're not jumping off to all of the different apps, then that browser is a persistent interface for you. Now, it's going to be really hard for Perplexity to get the type of distribution so that everyone's using their browser everywhere all the time. So that is a challenge. But like from a theoretical standpoint, that if the Comet browser or something like the Comet browser can be at that point of interface between you and all of your internet browsing activity and all of your model usage activity, then it can capture all of that that context and that data for you. I don't know who the players are going to be that really execute on that concept first, but I think that is one of the big opportunities, you know, that's available as we are going to be rewriting, you know, the whole foundational architecture of, you know, how people interact with technology. You know, like, are computers going to continue to be a thing? Is there going to be a new interface? Is it going to be a new device? OpenAI, you know, wants to build it with Johnny Ive, and we'll see, you know, what luck they have. I mean, they're doing a very good job at capturing consumer. Elon and XAI are kind of going a whole different route where they're trying to conquer, let's create the best scientist, engineer, coder AI, and then we'll be able to build better shit faster than everyone else. And, you know, if we can, like, their bet is on basically pace of innovation. Like, we're going to go all in on the bitter lesson, data, compute, having the resources to go as fast as humanly possible, balls to the wall, and just build the craziest shit imaginable as quickly as possible. And if we go fast enough, then we can probably out-iterate, you know, anyone, even OpenAI's consumer moat, you know, falls over time to the ability to just build way cooler, crazier shit way faster. And yeah, like, will they do the memory piece right? Who will, or will it that fall to someone else? Is someone in the open source space going to build that? These are big questions.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think the lesson there is, like, you know, OpenAI's lead has, it is non-existent in my view. I think open, like, from a technical perspective, from a, like the gap has narrowed to a point now where OpenAI's last couple releases have been sort of bungled, you know, and that is a direct result from my perspective.
But they have a huge lead in consumer mindshare and, like,
so that's the
consumer
point I'm trying
product
to make.
And memory too. So, like, they are kind of leading on memory, which is, you know, a moat
sure.
in consumer. But yeah, like, I would agree as far as the capabilities of their models as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, that they're not able to hold on to the lead in the best models in everything.
But the point I'm trying to make here is, if you don't have that, then over time, you're going to give that up to somebody else. And at some point, that somebody else, if they're accelerating faster than you are, it's going to create a big enough gap where a viral moment to capture mindshare will draw your membership from that platform to the other one, as long as the new player is giving a vastly superior service or result for what you're looking for, right? And so, like, if you look at the Studio Ghibli thing that ChatGPT came out with, that was a huge moment for them, from my perspective, right? Because from a capability perspective, it was like, who cares? It just it makes you into anime. But that's how you capture the like, normal people. It's like, oh my God, that's so cool. What is the tool that does that? Wow, look at this. I look so cute and bubbly, right? And then it's also, you know, the platform's probably like, hey, did you know you could also search this? And they're like, oh shit, really? And then all of a sudden they're like trapped, right? Because now they're like, oh my God, this thing can do everything for me, you know?
Yeah. So it's OpenAI's Snapchat moment.
Exactly. Exactly. But where's Snapchat now? Right. This is where OpenAI's long term is going to have a really big issue. So they've hemorrhaged a bunch of talent in the last year or two, like a ton of it, not just with Karpathy and Ilya and a bunch of other top tier engineers, talent leaders leaving the company. But you also have Zuckerberg throwing a bag and a half to everybody. Right. To try and lock them down. XAI is the only one that can retain talent because they have a mission and a leader that has an entire thing down pat, and acceleration towards the critical, sort of, like, how do I word this? XAI's lead to what AI could be in the long term is accelerating relative to everybody else. So at some point, you're going to create this gap between yourself and everybody else, and then you can already see with the companion thing, right? And the unhinged mode and Elon just doing weird shit with XAI and Grok. That is the team's attempt, from my perspective, to try and capture those viral moments that says, yo, look at our platform. It's crazy. If you can do some crazy stuff with it. And then you start kind of being like, oh, you can also do this. Oh, did you know you can also do this? Oh, did you know if you buy a Tesla car, you know, you already have a Tesla. This is going to be embedded in your Tesla car. Did you know, like, you can carry this along? And that's where the ecosystem starts to, like, come into play. And so in the same way that Apple has created this almost unbeatable ecosystem within the Apple product universe, you can see that Elon is trying to do the same exact thing with XAI and Tesla and every other player, and every other company that he's trying to build. There's going to be that marriage that's going to come.
So,
and that's going to be his long-term advantage.
I just want to, as you were talking, I want to make this prediction here and put it out on the record. My prediction is that Apple is going to get Twittered sometime in the next 10 years. That...
Ooh.
They are bungling their ecosystem right now. Obviously, it's a hugely valuable property.
I like that.
But they're sitting on this huge hoard of cash, right? So they've got runway. But their big fat hoard of cash, like, just the direction of the business is going to start getting so negative that there's going to be, you know, mass shareholder uprising, and someone is going to be able to execute a hostile takeover of the platform. In doing so, they're going to have to fire like 80% of that company. It's fucking awful. And then potentially the Apple ecosystem will have an opportunity to have life breathed back into it from an AI perspective.
So an AI company that's going to cash flow like crazy from its AI products, and
yep,
they will likely get to a multi-deca-trillion market cap in
market
the next
cap.
10 years,
yep,
then buying Apple is nothing. If Apple, yep, is going to be quote-unquote nothing. You know, let's go through. Yeah. Wow. I think they'll probably peak at like 3 or 4, maybe 5. They'll do their catch, you know, they'll do their buybacks, they'll do their dividends, sort of like, mm-hmm, how Legacy Auto has been doing it, right? And then the valuation for the company is just going to be like kind of like stagnant for years. And then as your Teslas, your Nvidias, your, you know, name your AI company, probably Tesla, you know, from that perspective, if they're going to the ecosystem perspective, if the bot is generating, you know, $250 billion of cash flow per year in 10 years or whatever that number is, and the robotaxi network is generating $200 billion or bot is generating $500 billion, these numbers get completely nuts, right?
Yeah.
Then I wonder if that's Elon's long-term goal for the robot, like the ecosystem is like, okay, Apple already has the supply chain for the phone. I don't want to deal with that shit. So all I'm going to do is I'm just going to make the cash flow machine go. I'm going to get myself a $10 trillion valuation, and I'm going to try to make a bid for Apple so I can bring them into my ecosystem, destroy, you know, like you said, fire 80% of their staff, just lean out the shit out of that freaking company, and then bake Grok into every iPhone, iPad, Mac that exists out there. And then that's how we get ourselves into like this. Okay, the Musk universe is now complete.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I don't know. Obviously, a scenario
talking
like
out
that
of my ass, right? I'm just
feasible.
Throwing ideas.
I just don't know if Elon would want to do that. You know, like it could be OpenAI. It could be,
sure,
one of these other companies that, you know, I think that would be a little bit more attractive too. But then again, you know, maybe not. So, I mean, the reason that I say that is because Apple is basically nothing without its Chinese supply base. And I just don't know that Elon wants to build an ecosystem that is so dependent on a Chinese supply base.
When he's already trying to diversify out of China.
Exactly. So
That's a very good point.
Unless we're at a point where geopolitically it's time to start mending fences and building bridges back. Yeah, and
that's,
I mean,
really
that's also a feasible scenario. But it is going to just be, you know, crazy to see. The reason that I think that that's inevitable is that I 100% expect, and I think, you know, this is not a controversial opinion, but for Apple to bungle a major device ecosystem shift that, you know, as phones continue to get more and more marginalized as computers and iPads and all these things, and we move to whatever is next, whether it's, you know, AR glasses are getting closer and closer and closer. And it doesn't seem like Apple has the juice to be able to figure out how to do that correctly, or whether it's, you know, something else. I mean, Neuralink devices is at some point going to be where this ends. I just don't expect them to be able to keep up with those types of shifts. And yeah, then, you know, the question is, how valuable is this legacy ecosystem that's built on a device platform that is less and less relevant?
I agree with you. And it is a scary proposition for Apple. It really is. But it's very difficult to see unless you track innovation and unless you've done your homework around the innovator's dilemma and just like and just viewing, you know, it's like a perfect use case of like what is today is not necessarily what is tomorrow. And Apple is so big and it seems so unbeatable. I mean, for, you know, I have an Apple Watch, I have an Apple iPhone, or have an Apple Mac, okay? But do I enjoy watching Apple completely and utterly fall flat on its face on artificial intelligence? The opposite. Because I can't tell you how many times I've been on my computer and I'm like, I wish I could just prompt my computer to do the thing I'm going to do for the next 2 hours. It's like, the computer should be able to analyze everything I've done when it comes to the process of, let's say, editing or researching or whatever I'm trying to do. It should have a memory bank of the steps up. It should know already. And there's nothing stopping me from, like, from a technical perspective, theoretically, in this day and age, and I get it, I'm oversimplifying the shit out of this, right? But there's nothing stopping me from, like, bringing up Spotlight or bringing up Siri, whatever that thing's going to be. Hey, can you run my editing process that I usually do for these videos and then just let me know when it's ready? And can you run this research process for me and just let me know when it's ready? Or I can do it right from my phone and it knows to go to my computer and do it. You know, like, why hasn't
Apple at the very least make Siri that's actually good? Like,
yeah,
that's
yeah, exactly.
Like, you have...
Why am I using Grok on my phone when you have Siri?
Yes. Or any of them, you know, like Gemini or ChatGPT. Like, why are these other things the only things that are good? It's like, you have the native ability. Like, all of this crap should be OS native. All of it.
Yeah.
And no one is in a better position to build OS native AI than Apple. But they're just pissing into the wind.
Yeah, it's an investor-led company. It's a legacy investor-based
company. It's a bean counter-led company. And that's
exactly,
you know, you can't.
Like, yeah,
bean counters are not innovators. Like, there's
no
more classic, personality stereotype in technological innovation.
Yeah, if your job is to squeeze as much money out of the like company as you can, by default, you're not going to take any risks whatsoever. Zero risks. Because taking risks means upsetting the apple cart. It means like we've literally upsetting the apple cart, okay? Like literally getting it to a point where you're introducing variables that are going to be difficult to track for the bean counters. And if the bean counters have a difficult thing to track, they're automatically going to throw a fit. I remember when I used to work at Philips, the pet food distributor that I was at before Tesla. Wonderful people, love that. I really love my time there. The leadership was awesome. I still talk to Blaine, who's the CEO of the company owner. And I remember accounting and finance was always the wall. And in a weird way, IT as well. In a lot of different ways, there were always the wall that would say, you know, like it was very difficult to get big things through because they're just the the culture of the company, which was at that size, which was a pretty, you know, I believe they're still the largest pet food distributor in the country. When you're at that size, which is what Apple is in the world of smartphone computing, et cetera, you don't want to introduce any craziness unless the leader of the company and the powers that be say that's okay. And that's why being a public company,
not just say it okay, but like, hey, you guys, we're doing this, whether you like it or not, figure it out.
Good. That's an excellent distinction because you're 100% right. That it's okay is not enough. It's if you don't do that, I'm going to fire you. Like you need to, I am going to pay you to try to break down as many barriers as you can. And it's going to suck. And you're going to have people yelling at your face. But that's what you're being paid to do. And the more you do that, the more I'm going to reward you. That's the only way you reverse that culture in that company, in Apple. But that starts with
if your board. CEO is the bean counter, then of course he's not going to go tell the bean counters, hey, I'm going to fire you if you don't be more bean countery.
But who put the CEO in charge? The board. And who controls the board? The investor base. Right.
Well, and so, I mean, Steve specifically appointed Tim Cook. So,
yeah, right.
Yeah.
So, and that's like, so Steve wanted Apple. So by doing that, Steve wanted Apple to go into a more controlled, like, I guess maybe Steve viewed it as, okay, I've done everything I can from an innovation perspective. I'm going to give it to somebody that I know is going to take good care of it. And he has. I mean, if you view it from like a supply chain perspective, like we've said it on the podcast before, Tim Cook is the GOAT maximizer of what you already have. Yep. The GOAT. Like Tesla should figure out how to get Tim Cook to run supply chain for the company, like the entire supply chain. And then Elon just in it. It's like, again, that Steve Jobs, Tim Cook relationship. Elon's out there. Visionary, this is what we're going to do. I don't give a shit. Or, you know, you can shut the fuck up. This is what we're going to do. And then Tim Cook is like, all right, we're going to make it happen. We're going to make it happen. But Tim Cook can't be, you know, it's a very, you know. And
I think Tim Cook is, his days of being told by a visionary CEO what to do are long over.
Yeah, that's very true. I think he would probably go retire in a random island before he has Elon down his fucking... Do this or I'll fire you. He has way too much money and way too much probably respect for himself to put himself in that position. No, but I sympathize with Tim because it's so hard to be the GOAT maximizer and also like one of the biggest innovators of our time. Like, good luck. That like we're asking Tim to be an impossible person, you know, and impossible people seem to be impossible unless your name is Elon Musk or Jensen Huang, Alex Karp, you know, Palmer Luckey,
Steve Jobs,
these guys, Steve Jobs,
Michael Dell.
Yep. You know, handful.
Jeff Bezos.
Yeah. There's like 10 of these guys, you know, or gals. I'm sure there's like a few.
I mean, there's a whole bunch of, yeah, probably up and coming people that, you know.
Elizabeth Holmes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe not.
A stain on entrepreneurship.
Yeah. Yep. But it's yeah. But, you know, if I circle back to sort of the AI ecosystem discussion, it's becoming quite obvious. You know, we were talking about this over chat over the weekend, like Comet, Perplexity Comet, the browser. You got the Johnny Ive project with ChatGPT trying to productize ChatGPT. You got Grok in the cars. You got the companions on Grok. You got... So many different companies trying to, like, if you think about the rabbit and the humane pin, you remember the rabbit thing, the orange little thing and the humane pin? Those things are objectively awful technologies, but the idea was actually correct. It was just ahead of its time, which is a thing that is with you all the time that just knows what to do. And that's what AI is going to solve for.
You know, it is a shot on goal at that idea that what you want is an OS native AI agent where the AI is, you know, it's with you basically everywhere all the time and it has access to the device and the capabilities of the device at the, you know, basically root level.
Why can't this do this now? It's crazy.
Especially when you have that, that is like seamlessly networked into your iPad and your MacBook. Like the MacBook is such a ridiculous, or like, you know, the Mac minis, like these are incredibly powerful computing devices with incredible AI. Like, you know, this is why people are using these in open source AI all the time, is because literally all of the components are present in the devices and they just can't do anything with it because they suck. Yeah. It, anyways, I know we've beat this horse, you know, to death, but it is a time in technology. I feel like this is the iPhone moment of the 2020s that,
oh yeah,
ChatGPT really kind of unlocked, except bigger, that, you know, there's so many implications to what AI can do that are far beyond what the internet was going to be able to do. And, you know, we needed the iPhone in order to really be able to take advantage of a lot of what the internet was capable of. That, you know, if you think about being able to transport information on the internet at the bandwidth that can handle video and audio and images and text and all, like, super seamlessly and super natively, that's awesome. But if you need a multiple $1,000, you know, computer that's plugged in at your house is the only way that you can access the internet, well, then, you know, the internet's TAM is pretty limited. But if you can have a $400 or $500 device that rides around in your pocket everywhere that you go every day, then all of a sudden, boom, like the TAM for the internet just exploded. And that is the overall arc, I think, that we're going on is right now, you know, AI is still kind of stuck for the most part, not stuck, but it is mostly living within the boundaries of text. You know, it's limited capability to really do images or audio or video well. It's getting there, it's getting better, but, you know, it's the early days. We haven't had the Windows 95 moment of multimodal AI capabilities. But we're definitely headed in that direction. And then, you know, the crazy thing is just that the cost of the actual tokens that are getting produced is just dropping like a rock to near free levels. So yeah, what this is going to be.
And for the audience that doesn't understand what a token is, it's basically the cost of compute to
just like, you know, a bit. Tokens are to AI what bits are to internet traffic and computers, basically.
Yeah, it's an unbelievable, it's literally happening. I think the thing that I'm trying to think through is like,
but it takes time, like, right? You know, because
the form factor has to be figured out.
The internet boom bust was the late 90s, and then, you know, busting in 2000, 2001.
We'll get one for AI.
Yeah, all of the things that we expected the internet to be able to do, eventually it was able to do. And really, you know, that was where you had a major depression in the technology sector all throughout the mid-aughts, you know, the early to mid-aughts, and then things started to pick back up. And then really just boomed in a huge way in the 2010s on the back of smartphones. And I think we're going to be kind of in a similar dynamic. It's going to be compressed. It's not going to take as long. But, you know, I think we've already gone through the inflated expectations of what AI can do. And then we've kind of hit the trough of, okay, what is it actually going to be able to do? I guess it's not going to be that cool. But we never got to this, you know, crazy multiples that we had in the,
That's true.
I think the market learned from the experience of the internet tech boom. They're like, hey, we can get excited about this, but we can't get that excited. Like, that's stupid. And so, you know, you see the multiples the earnings, like the values of the companies being a lot more tied to actual revenue, actual growth.
In the public market.
In the public markets. Yeah. And even, you know, I think there's been a pretty solid correction in the private markets as well. Like, I don't even think in the private markets they got to the types of insanity levels, even in peak ZIRP here, you know, in 2020, 2021, that the public markets were at in, you know, the tech and
Weiss
telecom
figure valued at $40 billion.
Because well, $40 billion is worth like $1 billion in 1995 dollars.
Yeah, it would be. So I'm actually going to ask. I'm actually curious. How much
inflation?
Let me ask Grok. Mr. Grok. We'll do a Grok four. How much is $40 billion today worth in 1995 inflation adjusted? All right.
Like five.
Hold on. What the hell? I'm doing that one. Oh, there we go. That was weird. It's thinking. Oh, here we go. Oh, no, it's thinking. I'm running it through Grok 4. Should have done Grok 3.
Okay.
We'll wait for it to run. It's a query. But yeah, I think that's a great point. And maybe, you know, I've been of the train of thought, like, the excitement around AI is palpable and people can feel it. But I think that what you said actually makes a lot of sense, where you're not seeing, like, If AI really was this incredible, like this incredible boom bust cycle, you would have valuations that are, you know, one could say this, one could say Tesla is a perfect example of the AI boom, but it hasn't busted yet, because you have a $1 trillion company that has 140 PE or 200 PE, depending on what, you know, how you're measuring PE. But then you also had a situation where Amazon was at 1,000 PE post .com bubble, right? So is it really that unusual where we are today? Do you have exceptions with certain companies getting insane valuations like Figure? Sure. Do you have things like, you know, OpenAI?
Well,
what did they get a value at? $230 billion or something?
Yeah, something like that. And I think people just expect, yeah, that these markets are going to be big. And if, you know, like if these players can actually have a significant presence in these huge markets, then they are worth that. And, you know, I think that there is some validity to that idea.
18 like, billion, by the way.
Okay, so 40 today is 18 in 1995?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think the bust is going to come in the private markets, not the public markets.
I think it has.
You think we're past that already?
I mean, I think, yeah, for the most part, that the companies that were, I mean, it's hard to say because, you know, a lot of the companies that are having to take big write downs, they're pre-AI like startups that haven't figured out how to ride the AI wave. But there's definitely been a big in you know, companies that were getting funded in 2020, 2021, the vast majority of them are already dead if they haven't figured out how to pivot.
So my concern is that when we inevitably start lowering interest rates in the coming years, in the next couple of years, that's going to create the boom cycle. That's the proper boom cycle. So your OpenAIs, your Figures, go down the list of like players are going to start getting these massive valuations in the private markets, okay? And then when the inevitable happens, which is in these technologies, there's going to be a winner take most, right? Those valuations are going to crash, but then the winner take most. The winner. Well, I guess that's not really a boom bust cycle, right? You're just transferring earnings from one company to another. That's just the market.
Yeah, and I mean,
yeah,
the level of CapEx that's involved in AI too is ridiculous, and so I think that
it's all going to NVIDIA.
Well, I mean, it's not just NVIDIA; it's going to a lot of things.
Yeah,
and
for sure, for
you
sure,
know, like
sure.
Energy companies and infrastructure companies all down the stack. Obviously, NVIDIA gets a big portion of it, and I don't think that's stopping anytime soon. Like, Meta's recent announcement on, you know, 2 gigawatt data centers and 5 gigawatt data centers. And yeah, like Elon is definitely driving the entire rest of the foundation. Like everyone who wants to play in AI is going to have to ante up to Elon's spending. And, you know, I don't know if anyone has checked recently, but Elon has kind of an insane ability to raise capital to spend on this and then to maximize the ROI on the capital that he spends. So like if other people are having to spend at the same level, but their ROIC is crappier, then like that's not sustainable over any, you know, significant period of time. I mean, Zuckerberg has the benefit of, you know, being able to siphon money off of his giant, you know, $1 trillion money printer with the Facebook business model, the Meta, you know, all the different properties, Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp, blah, blah, blah. But still, I mean, like, how many times can you spend hundreds of billions of dollars on building out the next layer of compute unless you figure out a way to keep your return on invested capital right side up? So it's gonna be crazy, and Nvidia is obviously the big winner in all that because they're still, you know, leading, they're still at the forefront of a general platform. You know, that's the thing that if you want to build something specific, you can probably outcompete Nvidia and maybe you can take back some of their margin. But if you want to continue to have the general platform that kind of works for whatever is happening in AI at any given point in time, no one has figured out how to crack the code on giving a full general platform. And that's, you know, I think that's the genius of Jensen Huang is that other people are focused on building chips and he's been focused on building ecosystems for decades. And he still has the premier AI ecosystem and
B2B ecosystem.
Well, yes, for the most part. And then other people, you know, figure out how to arbitrage there are big businesses that then arbitrage what NVIDIA can do to end consumers. So
it's so fascinating. Like that this ecosystem thing for businesses is like becoming such a huge trend for the next couple of decades. You know, like Palantir, NVIDIA, right? Tesla for transportation potentially and labor. So now you're like what that enables is like these floodgates to open for entrepreneurs to enter into a building ecosystem where the barrier of entry to build something valuable for society plummets. Whereas in the olden days, you would have to piece together these disparate software and hardware things together to make the end result work. And that's where the value of the business was figuring out how to put these things together. These companies are now reducing the complexity of the first step by a lot. Mm-hmm. And that's going to enable a lot of companies to enter. It's still going to be capital intensive, you know, but you don't have to learn how to like put crazy things together. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Who to hire for that. Yeah.
So I think that's 100%. Like there's never been a better time to be a founder than today. Like there's 100%. So many tools available at your disposal, whether it's technology, whether it's funding ecosystems that exist and support infrastructure. And, in the 1990s, if you started Google, it didn't matter that you're Larry Page and Sergey Brin, your investor base still kicks you out and installs Eric Schmidt and says, fuck you, you can't be CEO. Now, thankfully, Eric Schmidt was actually a really good CEO for Google and worked really well with, you know, Larry Page and Sergey. But, you know, that's not the industry norm anymore, thanks to just the way that VC has evolved since that time. And so that's, you know, kind of an important thing. But I think, you know, there's also a huge thing to be said for Elon's leadership in this, that really, you know, the PayPal mafia in general, but Elon specifically has just demonstrated that a lot of the things that you think cannot be done are just barriers in your head. They can. You just have to be willing to endure the, you know, glass eating, staring into the abyss process of making impossible things into a reality, even if it ends up coming late.
And you have to ask the right question to lead you down that path too. So you have to have little bit of talent and knowledge to ask the question, and then you eat the glass.
Yes.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's a huge inspiration for so many people that, like, obviously, even the smartest people, like Peter Thiel and David Sachs and these people that worked directly with him, still are just inspired by what it is that he is capable of doing. And then they, having had the bar set, it like, okay, like an Elon thing is a thing that is possible to exist. And so I can actually challenge the people that I invest in to rise to a level that is closer to Elon than, you know, like if we didn't know that that was possible, then we don't push people to try and get closer to that thing. But we know it is possible now. We can challenge ourselves to get closer to that thing. We can challenge our founders that we're investing in to get closer to that thing. Because like all of these people are now part of the VC ecosystem that, you know, David has been investing in SaaS companies for many, many years now. And obviously Peter Thiel has been an incredibly influential investor in tons of companies. And so between like Peter Thiel's first principle, like his crazy, insane brain and what he thinks is possible and the opportunities that he recognizes, and then the example of seeing what Elon can do, and then investing in people like Mark Zuckerberg or Palmer Luckey and enabling them to build their companies, that, you know, we just have this ecosystem that is so vibrant that people are able to do so many crazy, crazy things. And I'm really excited. You know, there's a couple of infrastructure companies right now that are doing incredibly cool things from first principles, that are going to make the land of what I'm going to term phys e-commerce, so physical e-commerce, into like something even greater than it is today with what Amazon has done. And, you know, maybe Amazon snaps these up, but Zipline is a drone delivery company that is doing awesome. And they have really nailed their technology. They have nailed the safety. They're rolling out in Dallas right now. You can order things from Walmart and have them literally dropped in front of your door. That's awesome. You will never hear a drone. Like, it hovers, you know, several hundred feet up in the air and drops the package down on a zip line. That's why they call it zip line. And they can hit a dinner plate, you know, out on your porch. And put your, whether it's your DoorDash, you know, thing, or your groceries or whatever it is that can carry up to 5 pounds. And, you know, that's way cheaper than having an Uber driver. Honestly, that's going to be way cheaper even than sending a Tesla robotaxi driving around on streets with your stuff. Now, if you need a larger delivery, like if you need a trunk full of groceries, then take the car. But if you need, you know, a toothbrush, well, send the zip line. Yeah. And that is going to be huge. Pipe Dream just released an announcement that they're starting up service in Austin, where it's kind of the boring tunnel version of Zipline, where they install just normal HDE pipe, like, you know, goes everywhere for sewer lines. It's relatively large. I think they do a pipe that's over a foot in diameter. And then they have little robot.
What was the name of the company?
Pipe Dream.
I'm pretty sure so I spoke to the founder.
He's right there in Capital Factory is where they're based. And they're a really cool little company. Their little cars can go up to like 100 mile an hour in their underground network of tunnels, and they can, you know, deliver. I think their weight limit is more than 5 pounds that Zipline is. And so they've got a whole cool thing, and they're starting out. They're going to do they're launching their own grocery. Like, it's pure delivery-based grocery store. So, you know, there's not going to be a physical location where anyone can go in and pick groceries. Like, you just order online, And then you go to one of their kiosks where these little carts can access, and you just drive up and pop out come your groceries, and then you get to drive off. And so, like, these are really cool, really cool new takes on ways to do business, ways to do e-commerce, in, and just, you know, way to move atoms in the physical world that use less energy, they cost less, they increase convenience, they increase customer experience, and they use technology to, you know, that's the magic of technology always, that, you know, without technology, we live in a world where you can have better, faster, and cheaper. Pick any two. You can have better and faster, but it's going to be expensive. You can have better and cheaper, but it's going to be slow. You can have whatever the other one is that I didn't think of there.
Faster, like,
you
and
can
cheaper.
Have two, yeah, you can have faster and cheaper, but it's going to be bad. And yeah, so technology allows you to have better, faster, and cheaper all at the same time. And we're going, you know, we're getting to have better, faster, cheaper now in the physical world, not just the world of bits, the internet and digital things. And it's going to come with, you know, a build out of an all new layer of infrastructure. And we're getting new primitives for this. Like, drones are a new primitive for the future of infrastructure. Whether they are drones that fly in the sky or drones that travel around in little tunnels under the ground, autonomous, and both of those things, they exist on a foundation of autonomous technology, whether they're drones that fly in the sky or drones that travel under the ground or Tesla robotaxis that travel on the roads. Like, all of these things are autonomous vehicles, yep, that transport goods from point A to point B without having to use human labor. And then each, you know, one of those things has their own, like, place that they slot in. And, like, how far do you need to transport something? How much does it weigh? And, you know, if you need to transport something not very far that doesn't weigh very much, well, then you want drones. If you want to maybe it doesn't weigh very much and you want to transport it a long ways, well, maybe you don't want the drone anymore. Maybe you want to do the underground thing. Then, you know, if it weighs a lot, well, yeah, now you need a car, or maybe you need a truck. But, like, all of this stuff, yeah, getting things from point A to point B is a huge part, you know, fraction of the total cost of any good that you consume in your life, period.
But the innovation is getting stuff from point A to point B to the door, right? Yeah. Because right now we have a lot of methods to do from source to in-between step, right? We have ships, we have planes, we have trucks, we have railroad, right? Trains. But and that can get disrupted as well. Like, don't get me wrong. But the major innovation here that has so much room for innovation is when it lands in the warehouse or the nearby place, basically the warehouse nowadays, is like, how do we get that thing from the warehouse, whichever makes the most sense, nearest to the location, to the customer's front door? And Amazon innovated on, well, we just make really big warehouses everywhere so that we can create, and then we'll use the existing thing that we use
drive
for
around
the
trucks. Yeah,
exactly. And we drive it around their trucks. Exactly. But those trucks still have routes. You're still going to run through. And now they're doing a thing with, like, the drivers, right? So you can be a random driver driving for Prime, and then you can deliver for Prime, just like, kind of like Uber Eats, but for Amazon packages. And a lot of these people are drivers. But I mean, that is a perfect use case. Fortunately or unfortunately, depending on which side you are, as a customer, it's perfect for the robotaxi or some sort of self-driving car to do that, because now you no longer have the cost of the delivery in the driver. And then if you're the driver, then you are in a world of hurt if you can't find a place to land.
But then they do have economy. To solve the challenge of getting it from the truck to the doorstep, which is
human or robots, whatever.
Well,
human or robots,
yeah,
little thing that, you know, little thing with wheels that catches with the arm.
I mean, that's the thing that's awesome about Zipline, is it really solves that problem kind of with its current form factor for basically anything except hotels and apartments. Like, you know, hotels and apartments need to have their own deal, but that's already kind of accounted for. Like, you just have to get things to the office, and so the office needs a place that is set up to receive.
Yeah, the zip line, I mean, I have to do a deep dive. I mean, the cost of operation of a zip line drone is probably like, what, like 2 cents a minute or something, maybe less, a cent a minute or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, we'll it's low. I don't know what it is. Yeah.
But it can't be toothbrushes, right? It has to be like.
I mean, 5 pounds, you know, is a lot.
Yeah, five pounds is a lot. But if I'm viewing it from like a logistics perspective, so when I was at the warehouse, when I was at the Philips, when I was working at the warehouse as a BI manager, and the director of pricing, like the thing you would always try to maximize for is how much can I cube out the truck with the highest value possible. And so that when you're going from point A to point B, you're carrying as much margin dollars, right, in that truck as so when you're delivering that product, okay, you're delivering it makes sense. So that all the costs you've put into that truck, it's like it makes sense for you to go out there. You don't want to do routes, you don't want to do deliveries where the cost of transporting the goods is more than the cost that you're carrying. Exactly.
Yep.
Exactly. And so for Zipline, the question becomes, how many products are out there that are 5 pounds or less, where the cost of shipping, which is going to be based on the value of the product, I'm going to guess, has a good enough ratio so that you can actually, it does make sense to do. So it can't be toothbrushes. It can't be toilet paper. It can't be, you know, like low dollar, high weight. It has to be high dollar, low weight products, right? So like jewelry would be perfect for this.
Well, I mean,
you know, stuff like that.
I think that, you know, just like Amazon Prime, you pay the flat rate, that there's a sure. network effect dynamic.
This is true.
That the marketplaces are going to be willing to subsidize the delivery portion in order to drive their just overall, you know, number of transactions. It's like, yeah, you've got to eliminate the friction in the consumer's mind to just pressing the buy button anytime and every time that they feel like they want to. So I think that will end up coming into play at some point. Like, it might take Zipline and Pipe Dream and these other things a while to get to the point where, you know, some player makes that calculation and goes ahead and invests that type of money in it. But at some point it happens.
Yeah. And the Ziplines, I mean, really all of these companies, they're for it to make sense, is going to come down to cost of batteries. You know, like what's their what hour per mile traveled or something. And then as that technology improves, dude, everything is batteries in this day and age, right? So in the next 20, it's batteries, which blows my mind that the Trump administration would be so backwards when it comes to that.
Yeah, and that's true for every single thing that we just talked about, whether it's the Zipline drones, whether it's Pipe Dream,
everything.
Whether it's robo-taxis, whether it's Tesla semis, like
all
of these things need batteries, and they need good batteries, and they need, yeah, like you need the technology solution to batteries that I talked about.
What was the thing? Better, faster, cheaper?
Yep.
Better batteries that you can manufacture at a faster rate that costs less.
Wow. Yep. And also charge and discharge faster. Like, there's faster on multiple dimensions.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
So, but I do think that the overarching theme here is, I do think there is a lot of reason to be very optimistic about the next 10 to 20 years. I think the vision is crystallizing. Having been fortunate enough to be invited to RoboTaxi, it's really opened my eyes to like this is happening, you guys. Not just RoboTaxi. Like, RoboTaxi is happening. Self-driving cars.
RoboTaxi is like the first installment of AI eating stuff in the physical world.
In the physical world, yeah. Exactly. Which kind of crystallizes it more, I think, for the average person, because you can actually see it. Whereas like ChatGPT is a little bit more esoteric. And the people that will feel it are the ones that are being directly impacted by the disruption versus, like, you know, I think it's harder to conceptualize AI disrupting a radiologist versus a self-driving car disrupting a delivery driver. It's a lot easier to, because people know how to drive.
People focus on the drivers, which I think, you know, it's valid, but you know, at the same time, why is the driver being disrupted? It's because the AI and the batteries are able to do the job of the person for 1/10 the cost or something like that, which means that all of the people who need that service can get that service much, much cheaper. And so there are going to be, you know, hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands, potentially hundreds of thousands of people that lose their jobs to this technology.
Millions.
Over time.
Millions.
But all of the people that are consuming those products and services, they're going to get those products and services at way cheaper. And so like humanity as a whole gets richer in total. Like every human has access to more stuff and in real terms gets richer while some people lose their jobs and end up having to figure out how to get by. And so that, you know, that is obviously one of the challenges we've talked about a ton on this channel and will continue to have to talk about for years and years and years, is how do we as a society order the social contract that allows everyone to get richer and takes care of the people that are getting disaffected as this technology makes everyone more, you know, more wealthy.
Exactly. And this is actually, I'm curious to pick, we have Emily coming on the channel later this week to discuss a little bit like some political stuff, but this is like, you know, with the provable rise of socialism in Western countries, especially in the United States, and the disruption that's going to come from artificial intelligence, what is going to be the political dynamic in this country specifically when these jobs get disrupted? Is it going to be, we're going to try our best to create an environment for these people that are disrupted to find a better path forward? Or are we just going to say, let the government take care of you, right? The trend is, let the government take care of you. And I don't think it's good for our country to create a forcing function to entice people that are going to suffer from disruption to be like, and let's say they're in their 30s and 20s or 40s even, right? I think creating a forcing function for these folks to exit the economy when there's no better time to build, literally, which could give them a pathway to 1,000 times more wealth and 1,000 times more opportunities and 1,000 times more joy and happiness potentially, right? Versus like a ceiling that it's going to set by default. These are going to be the questions of our time. Yeah. And I'm getting uncomfortable.
The biggest thing that scares me is that obviously like... a big part of the role of the government is the redistribution machine. And, you know, this is why government always grows, is the, you know, people want more redistribution to have it like, hey, those people have too much. We want some of that. Here, let's, you know, vote for the government to get bigger so that they can steal more from other people and give it to us. And like, that is legitimately something that is going to be needed, I think, the, you know, that redistribution mechanism. But what I hope we don't do, and what I fear that we are going to do, is to do that in a permanent way in a government structure that lives on forever, essentially, or, you know, until it collapses the society underneath it, under its giant fat weight. So what, you know, I think just conceptually from a high level, I would be more interested in seeing is some sort of a temporary non-governmental, like third-party structure that self-destructs after a specific period of time and, you know, has that sunset written into it from the beginning in a non, like an unavoidable way that, you know, people can't then just vote to postpone the sunset and keep this thing active, and that it's solely meant to shepherd a transition of a specific generation of people from, here to there, and after that job is done, that it ceases to exist permanently.
You can almost do that with blockchain and Bitcoin.
I think that we have the both technological and philosophical tools at our disposal to build that kind of stuff.
Do we have the will?
Yeah.
It's always like the age-old question, you know? Do we have the will? There's always a way. Do we have the will? Especially now, and definitely especially in the next 10 years, for sure. Like, we'll be able to do basically anything, you know? Which is so unbelievably exciting. Anyway, okay.
Yeah.
Leave it there?
Yeah.
It's crazy. The robotaxi thing has been like, it's just been consuming the hell out of my neurons. It's unbelievable. It's like, I can't stop thinking about it. Experiencing it in person all the time is melts your brain in the best way possible. It does.
It was so crazy to me how fast, and I don't want to stick on this for too long, how fast it just gets to be normal. Like literally 5 minutes after you're in the car, you're like, oh, this is a thing. I guess that meant that. Like,
yeah.
And you see it drive up to you with nobody in it, and you're like, that safety monitor doesn't even need to be there. Like,
yeah,
what a bullshit job he has.
Yeah, it goes from like, this is the greatest thing I've ever seen to, oh my God, what's on social media? Wow, I can finally listen to my podcast in peace. Blah, 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 you know?
Yeah, you go from like being on the lookout, hey, what situation is going to trip up the robotaxi, to being like, dude, I can't find anything. I'm bored. Like,
yeah, exactly. The smoothness of the ride and how good it is at driving is what drives that, right?
Oh, that's 100%. That's the thing. It makes you 0% nervous. And it just does so good so fast that it just like lulls you into this like sense of comfort and confidence almost instantly.
It's almost like... It's impossible to communicate until you experience it. It's literally impossible. It's one thing to have FSD, the latest version of FSD in your car behind the steering wheel and pedal, which gives you a signal that says, oh shit, if I wasn't here, this car probably is doing it just fine on its own. And then it's entirely another thing to go in the robotaxi in the back seat, no one's in the driver's seat, and you're like, oh wow, it's actually better than I thought. It's actually better than I thought. Because now I'm not even in control. And it's doing better than I would have. And better, it's subjective, but I would say in a world of self-driving vehicles, it's also an objective fact to have a
better at providing a comfortable drive to the passengers in the back.
Bingo. With that objective truth, it is better at doing that than 95% of drivers out there.
Probably, maybe even more than that.
Maybe more.
It takes someone who's specifically trying to provide you chauffeur level ride quality.
100%. You got it. Yeah. And
with perfect awareness, like with perfect 360 degree awareness at all times.
Yeah. Yeah. Impossible to communicate unless you're in the car. Impossible. So anyway, if you're in Austin,
go ride the Schlong.
Go ride the Schlong. Well, first you got to get invited, and then maybe, in the coming weeks, I can make some time and give some. Actually, I'm traveling these next couple of weeks, so I will be able to. Dan, hopefully by August they open up the geofence. I was going to say maybe I can give some rides to people that live here, but my schedule is so freaking jam packed; it's unbelievable. So, it is what it is. Okay, bye.